In the new book, Breath, my guest, journalist James Nestor, writes about many aspects of how we breathe and how we can train ourselves to breathe in ways that may improve our health and the quality of our sleep and decrease anxiety. He reports on why mouth breathing is related to snoring, sleep apnea, and other problems, what the nose has that the mouth doesn't, different breathing techniques to de-stress, reduce blood pressure, and balance the nervous system, and how free divers train to expand their lung capacity so that they can dive deep and stay underwater for up to 12 minutes on one breath. When possible, Nestor's tried what he's written about, including participating in an experiment at Stanford in which his nose was completely plugged for days to test the impact of breathing solely through the mouth. The results were fascinating, but the experience of total mouth breathing was unpleasant and disrupted his sleep. Nestor is also the author of a previous book called Deep, Free Diving, Renegade Science, and What the Oceans Tell Us About Ourselves. And he helped found a research initiative to investigate how sperm whales communicate with each other through clicks. We originally broadcast this interview last month. James Nestor, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thanks so much for having me.
Has your research into breathing taking on a slightly different meaning because of COVID-19, because of its respiratory systems and the anxiety that it's creating?
I think the awareness of breathing has definitely increased. When I first started this research several years ago, a lot of my friends were saying, "You're writing a book about breathing? I've been breathing my whole life. Why would you want to write a book about that?" But now these are the same friends who are seeing how essential respiratory health is in helping us both prevent the onset of many illnesses and to help us get through illnesses like COVID, to help us better get through them.
So you had been a mouth breather. And you did some snoring. You had a deviated septum, which was affecting your ability to breathe through your nose because that kind of clogs part of the nose or blocks part of the nasal passage, I should say. So to understand whether mouth breathing was really a problem, you participated in a study at Stanford University that forced you to breathe through your mouth. Describe what the setup was.
Yeah, so I had been in contact with the chief of rhinology research, Jayekar Nayak, for months and months. We had had several interviews, we'd been talking a lot, and he was telling me all the wonders of nasal breathing and how bad mouth breathing was. And none of that was controversial. That's very well established now. But nobody really knew how all the problems of mouth breathing, no one knew how soon those came on. So I asked him, I said, "Well, why don't you test it? You're in a position to test it." He's like, "How am I going to test it? It would be unethical to ask someone to plug their nose for a certain amount of time and measure what happens." And I said, "Well, I'll do it." So it was never like a supersize me study. That wasn't our intention. If 25 to 50% of the population is breathing through their mouth. So I was just lulling myself into a condition I already knew and that so many other people already knew. So the plan was for 10 days, I would have silicone plugs up my nose. Me and one other subject, a breathing therapist from Sweden, I convinced him to do this study as well. And for the other 10 days, we would change the pathway of how we breathe and breathe through our noses instead of our mouths. So that was it. That was the setup. And, you know, we thought that mouth breathing for 10 days was going to be bad, but we had no idea it was going to be so damaging.
How bad was it?
Well, I went from snoring a couple minutes a night to within 3 days, I was snoring 4 hours a night. I developed sleep apnea. My stress levels were off the charts. My nervous system was a mess. We had a whole home lab here at my house. So we were testing each other 3 times a day, every day, and writing out all of these metrics. We even had, we're looking at blood glucose, how that was affected. So I felt awful. I felt fatigued, snoring, sleep apnea, all the rest. And even performance, athletic performance really, really decreased as well. And the good thing about this is I was able to take these god-awful plugs out of my nose and breathe nasally again. And once I did that, snoring disappeared, sleep apnea disappeared. Nervous system came back into balance. I mean, completely transformed by just changing the pathway through which we breathed.
So what's in the nose that makes nose breathing better than mouth breathing because mouths don't have that stuff.
So the nose filters, heats, and treats raw air. Most of us know that. But so many of us don't realize, at least I didn't realize, how it can trigger different hormones to flood into our bodies, how it can lower our blood pressure, how the stages of a woman's menstrual cycle are correlated to different areas of the nose, how it monitors heart rate, on and on and on, even helps store memories. So it's this incredible organ that is not represented in any of the departments of the National Institutes of Health. And this is something that NIAC has, you know, just hammered down over and over again. He's like, why aren't we studying this more? And why don't more people realize how important nasal breathing is? So it orchestrates innumerable functions in our body to keep us balanced.
What I found most surprising was that the nose actually has erectile tissue, like men's and women's genitals.
So the nose is more closely connected to our genitals than any other organ. So it is covered in that same tissue. So when one area gets stimulated, the nose will become stimulated as well. Some people have too close of a connection where they get stimulated in the southerly regions. They will start uncontrollably sneezing. And this condition is common enough that it was given a name called honeymoon rhinitis. Wow. So this is the weird stuff you never thought you'd discover when you start writing a book about breathing. But another thing that is really fascinating is that erectile tissue will pulse on its own. So it will close one nostril and allow breath in through the other nostril. Then that other nostril will close and allow breath in. And our bodies do this on their own. And this switching happens between 30 minutes and every 3 hours. And a lot of people who have studied this believe that this is the way that our bodies maintain balance. Because when we breathe through our right nostril, circulation speeds up, the body gets hotter, cortisol levels increase, blood pressure increases. So breathing through the left will relax us more. So blood pressure will decrease, lowers temperature, cools the body, you know, reduces anxiety as well. So our bodies are naturally doing this. And when we breathe through our mouths, we're denying our bodies the ability to do this and to keep us in balance.
But what about if you can't breathe through your nose because either you have a cold or a respiratory illness or you have a bad deviated septum?
Sure. Around 70% of the population has a deviated septum that's clearly visible to the naked eye. So this is just rampant. And I certainly do. When I got a CAT scan of my head, it was an absolute mess. But some conditions are so severe that you will need surgical intervention for sure. But the vast majority are not. And something Nayak kept telling me is he said, you know, if a sink is clogged in your house, you're going to find a way of unclogging it. The nose should be considered in the same way. If your nose is clogged, you need to find a way of unclogging it. You can do that by breathing more through your nose because it's really a use it or lose it organ. The more you breathe through it, the more you're going to be able to breathe through it. I was just talking to a clinician who's trained something like 7,000 people to nasal breathe, and only 4 of them could not breathe through their noses after about 3 weeks of training. So it's really something. The more we focus on it, the more we really concentrate, the more we're able to open it up and to get all those benefits of nasal breathing.
So after you did this experiment about breathing exclusively through your mouth, you decided at night to try taping your mouth so that you couldn't breathe through your mouth and you'd have to breathe through your nose. How did that go?
Yeah, so this is something, a hack that I had heard about and was extremely skeptical about. It sounded very dangerous to me until I talked to a breathing therapist at Stanford who said that she had cured her own mouth breathing by taping her mouth at night. And until I talked to a dentist who'd been in the field for 20, 30 years who prescribes this to his patients. Now, I'm not talking about getting a fat piece of duct tape and taping that over your mouth. That's a really bad idea. I'm talking about a teeny piece of surgical tape, about the size of a stamp. Imagine like a Charlie Chaplin mustache moved down an inch. And my personal experience with this is it has allowed me to sleep so much better, wake up so much more rested, and to not have that dry mouth every morning.
So with the kind of tape you're talking about, if your mouth really needed to open, it could, because that's not, like you said, it's not like really strong tape. It's just like surgical tape and a little piece of it. So you're
You're
not gagging yourself.
Yeah, and I'm not prescribing. I'm not qualified.
And you're not prescribing it. And neither am
I'm not prescribing anything. No, yeah. No. I'm saying this personally worked for me, but don't go on YouTube. Don't go on the internet and see these people with 9 pieces of tape over their lower jaws. Like, bad idea. I've found all you need is a very small piece of tape. And there's even a product out right now that is being sold as a remedy for snoring. And what is it? It's a piece of tape that you put on your lips at night. So other people, and they've conducted studies to show how effective it is. So this worked well for me. It's worked well for many other people, but I'm not prescribing anything.
And I should mention that my guest, James Nestor, is also not a doctor. He's a journalist, and he's reporting on what he's learned by talking to many researchers and doctors and people who practice breathing techniques and teach breathing techniques. Breathing is automatic, but we can control, when we consciously try, the quality of the breath, the length of inhales and exhales, and how deeply or shallowly we breathe. Can you explain why breath would, for instance, affect anxiety and how breathing in certain ways, certain breathing techniques can decrease anxiety? Anxiety
Sure.
being a very important subject right now.
So for so many of us, we think that it's just important that we're breathing, because if we're breathing, that's good. That means we're alive. If we're not breathing, that's bad. You know, could be dead. But it's how we take those breaths. We take 25,000 breaths a day, and 30 pounds of air enters and exits our lungs every day. So it's how we take those breaths and the nuances of those breaths that I've found play such an important role in health, happiness, and longevity. So specifically with anxiety, talked to a neuropsychologist, went out to his lab at the Laureate Institute of Brain Research, and he explained to me that people with anxieties or other fear-based conditions typically will breathe way too much. So what happens when you breathe that much is you're constantly putting yourself into a state of stress. So you're stimulating that sympathetic side of the nervous system. And the way to change that is to breathe deeply. Because if you think about it, if you're stressed out, a tiger's going to come get you, you're going to get hit by a car, you're going to breathe as much as you can. But by breathing slowly, that is associated with a relaxation response. So the diaphragm lowers, you're allowing more air into your lungs, and your body immediately switches to a relaxed state. So we may not be able to control the function of our hearts, other organs in our body, but we can control our breathing. And when we control our breathing, we can influence so much of how our bodies operate. And that includes, as a treatment, or at least a practice for people with anxieties, depression, just changing their breathing, psychiatrists have found, can have a very transformational effect. It seems so simple to be true, but some of these people have been studying this subject for decades, and that's what they've found.
There are many different breathing techniques. There are many different breathing meditation styles. What do they all have in common? Is there something they all have in common in terms of inhale and exhale and the basic principles underneath?
So breathing's been studied for thousands and thousands of years. There are 7 books of the Chinese Tao that deal only with breathing. What happens when we do it improperly and all of the benefits we can get by doing it properly. So all of those ways, all of the different practices do have one thing in common, and that's because they allow you to slow down and consciously listen to yourself and feel how breath is affecting you. So there's many different tools in this toolbox. If you want to slow down and become more relaxed, you can exhale longer than you inhale. So that will have a very powerful effect on you for relaxation. If you want to stimulate yourself and get going, you can breathe much faster. So what I've found is throughout time, throughout millennia, these different cultures at different times, different peoples were discovering the same exact thing over and over. So it's very interesting that right now we have the science and the techniques and measurements to really prove what these people have been saying for so long.
Why does the exhale quiet the system?
Because the exhale is a parasympathetic response. Right now, you can put your hand over your heart. If you take a very slow inhale in, you're going to feel your heart speed up. As you exhale, you should be feeling your heart slow down. So exhaling relaxes the body. And something else happens when we take a very deep breath like this. So the diaphragm lowers when we take a breath in. And that sucks a bunch of blood, a huge perfusion of blood into the thoracic cavity. As we exhale, that blood shoots back out through the body. So the diaphragm is considered the second heart because it plays such a huge role in circulation, and it lowers the burden of the heart if we breathe properly and if we really engage the diaphragm. So these slow and low breaths, people should be practicing these as much as possible. This is the way your body wants to take in air.
If you want to start breathing to calm yourself down, do you have any suggestions for the length of the inhale and the length of the exhale?
Sure. And this was a study I stumbled upon that's about 20 years old now, that some Italian researchers gathered a group of subjects and they had them recite the Ave Maria, so the Catholic prayer cycle. And then they had them recite Om Mani Padme Hum, which is a Buddhist prayer. What they found is that it took about 5.5 seconds to recite each of these prayers, and then about 5.5 seconds to then inhale. And so by breathing about 5.5 seconds out, 5.5 seconds in, they found that blood to the brain increased. The body entered this state of balance in which all of the organs, all of the system worked in harmony with one another. And they covered these people with sensors and were able to see all of this all on data sheets. And the study is widely available. So they later found that you don't need to really pray to get these benefits, even though you can do that if you'd like. But just by breathing at this rate, about 5.5 seconds in, 5.5 seconds out, don't worry if you're a second off. You know, the point is to relax yourself. You are able to get the perfect amount of air into your body and out of your body and really allow your body to do what it's naturally designed to do, which is function with the least amount of effort. And they've taught this breathing, psychiatrists have taught this breathing pattern to people with anxiety, depression, even 9/11 survivors who had this ghastly condition called ground glass lungs, and it had significant effects on them by just breathing this way.
You've said if you exhale longer than you inhale, that can be very calming. So if both the inhale and the exhale are 5.5 seconds, you're not doing a longer exhale. Does that matter?
So the body wants to be balanced, right? We want sympathetic balance. We want parasympathetic balance. So just in regular day-to-day activity, you want to have that balance. Before you go to sleep, you can extend that exhale and become more relaxed. But I would not be extending that exhale before a meeting or before an important phone call. So you can use these different tools to do different things. You can also inhale longer and exhale shorter if you want a little boost of energy. So the even Steven, like the most balanced way of breathing that I've found after studying this stuff and talking to the leaders in the field, was that 5 to 6 seconds in, 5 to 6 seconds out.
James, you know, in talking about breath and its impact on our health and our anxiety, you referred to the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system. Without going into too much detail, can you just explain briefly what each of them are and why they're relevant to breath?
Sure. The sympathetic nervous system is the system that triggers a fight or flight reaction. So when we sense danger, the sympathetic nervous system switches on, floods our bodies with stress hormones, and allows us to become meaner and leaner and to fight harder or to run really fast. That's what that does. So the parasympathetic is the opposite. This is the side of the nervous system that triggers a rest and relax response. And we want to be in this state when we're eating food, mostly throughout the entire day. We want to be in a parasympathetic state. The problem is that nowadays, all of us are kind of half stressed. We're not really running away from a tiger or a lion or fighting for our lives, but we're not really relaxing either. So we're staying in this gray zone where during the night, we're half awake, and during our days, we're half asleep. So that's what I found was so interesting about breathing is by just breathing, you can elicit these different nervous system states. So you can take command of something that was supposed to be autonomic. That's what it's called, the autonomic nervous system. But you can control it, and you can stress yourself out if you want, or you can relax yourself just by breathing.
What are the things that we typically do wrong when we breathe? Like, speaking for myself, I think I'm a very shallow breather when I'm not paying attention to my breathing. I think my kind of go-to state is just shallow breaths. So what's wrong with that?
Well, you can think about breathing as being in a boat, right? So you can take a bunch of very short, stilted strokes, and you're going to get to where you want to go. It's going to take a while, but you'll get there. Or you can take a few very fluid and long strokes and get there so much more efficiently. So your body doesn't want to be overworked all the time, because if it is, then things start to break down. So you want to make it very easy for your body to get air, especially if this is an act that we're doing 25,000 times a day. So by just extending those inhales and exhales, by moving that diaphragm up and down a little more, you can have a profound effect on your blood pressure, on your mental state, on even on longevity, because so much of longevity is correlated with respiratory health and lung size.
James Nestor is the author of the new book, Breath, The New Science of a Lost Art. Our jazz critic, Kevin Whitehead, has spent a lot of time over the past few years watching movies set in the jazz world. He has a new book about films that tell stories about jazz called Play the Way You Feel. Here's his take on what he calls the stock jazz movie ending.
Over 90-some years of movies about jazz, some plot points and story elements keep coming back. We see young musicians who'd been mentored by African-American elders who work basement clubs and want to play the way they feel when the man just wants them to play the music as written. It's the movies, so there are romantic complications, sometimes tied to divergent musical tastes. Such problems may be resolved in a version of the stock jazz movie ending, a big New York concert where parties at odds are reconciled. It turns up by 1937 in the romantic comedy Champagne Waltz. Fred McMurray plays a saxophonist who turns old Vienna onto jazz, killing business at the Waltz Palace next door and wrecking Fred's romance with the Waltz King's opera singer granddaughter. In the end, they're all on stage in New York. Romantic and musical differences are resolved as gigantic jazz and classical orchestras mesh on a swinging the classics mashup of Tiger Rag and the Blue Danube. It's kitschy music, but clear storytelling, symbolizing the wedding to come. That ending got tweaked in the 1938 Irving Berlin Songfest, Alexander's Ragtime Band, moving the reconciliation between bandleader and singer to Carnegie Hall, the gold standard for classy venues in the movies. That template came back with minor variations for decades. In 1947's The Fabulous Dorseys, battling brother bandleaders Jimmy and Tommy Dorsey, playing themselves, patch up their feud just long enough to play a double concerto, just as the real Dorseys cooperated long enough to make the movie. A couple of months later came the film New Orleans, with the most over-the-top New York concert ending, which clears the way for an opera singer to marry a jazz booker. At Symphony Hall, the singer, a choir, three pianos, a Philharmonic Orchestra, and Woody Herman's big band all cram on stage to murder the film's instant hit song, which we've already heard Billie Holiday do rather better. The New York concert capper turns up through the 1950s, a jazz movie tradition, as in The Benny Goodman Story, or St. Louis Blues, where W.C. Handy's disapproving people finally accept his blues music when it's performed in concert alongside Mozart and Mendelssohn. More variations came later. In 1972's Lady Sings the Blues, after an endless U.S. tour, Diana Ross's Billie Holiday is finally allowed to play New York again, at Carnegie with the violins. The real Holiday did play Carnegie Hall, but without the fiddles. In 2016's Nina, Zoe Saldana's Nina Simone, who's been living in bitter French exile, plays a free concert in Central Park and discovers her people still love her, reconciling Nina Simone and America. No reconciliation ending has grander implications than that. Fishing the sea, you know how I feel. Never running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day. There are other examples, but you get the idea. Reworking durable plot points isn't unique to jazz films, of course. That's just storytelling. Still, these particular echoes and variations reinforce parallels between jazz and filmmaking. Because jazz musicians also work myriad variations on set themes and sometimes fall back on stock licks when inspiration fails, and sometimes knowingly quote from older works to affirm the historical continuum. Jazz, like the movies, can sometimes spin a familiar lick to make it seem new again and worth bringing back one more time.
Do you know what it means to miss New Orleans and miss it each night and day? Getting stronger the longer I stay away.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Tone Audio. His new book is called Play the Way You Feel, The Essential Guide to Jazz Stories on Film. Our guest science writer Sonia Shaw has written several books, including one that's made her a sought-after interview guest lately. That book, published in 2016, is called Pandemic. She explored the increasing threat of viral outbreaks and her own personal experience with contagious infections. Her new book explores another subject of intense interest in recent years, immigration. While the Trump administration and some European governments are hardening their borders and cracking down on immigrants, Shaw argues that mass migration is nothing new in human history, or for that matter, the history of plants and animals. For centuries, she writes, prominent intellectuals have regarded migrants as menacing deviants, defying the natural order that places everyone in a singular natural setting. But, she says, science now shows that migration among all species is a biological imperative, as important as breathing. Sonia Shaw's new book is called The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. She spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Well, Sonia Shah, welcome back to Fresh Air. In an interview at the end of January of this year, you said that COVID-19 will be bigger, more dangerous, and more economically damaging than the SARS epidemic. You were right. How did you know?
Well, it seemed early on, it was clear that this pathogen had kind of found the sweet spot between how deadly it was on one hand, which is not terribly deadly compared to all the pathogens out there that we've had, but it was just deadly enough and transmissible enough to spread really widely and cause a lot of death and disruption. So the first SARS was a lot more deadly, but less transmissible. So it kind of burnt itself out on its own. But this is something that can really sustain itself because it doesn't kill everyone. You know, it has a lot of asymptomatic spread and all of those. So the basic parameters of this virus made it clear pretty early on that this could be the next big one. And of course, now we know what it is.
Right. And you've had a couple of months more experience to see this unfold. What has surprised or impressed you about the shape of this pandemic?
Most of it is pretty similar, the way we're responding, the process by which the pathogen is moving through populations. I mean, there's this confrontation between a human population that's had no experience with this thing and suddenly it coming into population. So we've seen that before in history. I think what's really been so surprising and unexpected about the way this pandemic is unfolding that really I don't think anyone predicted was the U.S. response being so chaotic and dysfunctional. And I don't think anyone really predicted that. You know, no one really predicted that the CDC would become an institution that not everyone trusted anymore. You know, that the US government would not put forward a vigorous sort of federally led response. So that has been very surprising. And I think that has changed how the pandemic and the response has unfolded.
You've been interviewed a lot about the coronavirus. And one thing I've heard you say is that what we take out of this will depend upon the stories that we tell ourselves. And when you look at the divergent and competing narratives that we see, it's pretty striking. You have one side saying, well, this came from China or may have come from China, even perhaps a Chinese government lab, and that the administration's response was swift and effective, and the death toll is probably inflated, so it's not actually that bad. And then another side that has a completely different view. I'm wondering, are we going to end up with an accepted understanding of what's happened here?
I mean, I think all the stories that we're telling right now conform to a basic narrative, which is that we have been invaded by this intruder. You know, whether we say it's a Chinese virus or it's from Wuhan or, you know, from some otherworldly place, maybe it's a bat or some strange eating habit or, you know, something outside of us. There's this sense of us being the passive victims of these invasive germs. And I think that kind of paradigm of, you know, I call it kind of microbial xenophobia. It's, you know, it's rooted in our history of how we've treated contagious diseases. It's rooted in germ theory, the advent of scientific medicine and all of that. And it's helped us in a lot of ways with antibiotics and vaccines. You know, we think of the microbe as this invasive contaminant, and then we target it with killing chemicals. But what it obscures is our own role in creating the opportunities that allow microbes to turn into pathogens and to spread between us. And the problem with that is right now, we have this new pathogen here. We're not going to have drugs and vaccines to save us from it in the short term. What we need to do is change our behavior. But the way we talk about the pathogen really obscures the role of human behavior in all of this. So I think that is something that we need to kind of grapple with.
Right. And so how do we need to change our behavior?
A lot of ways. I mean, I think we need to look more deeply at the way we're interacting with nature. We need to look more deeply at the crisis of biodiversity, which is really the fundamental driver of all of these spillover pathogens coming into human populations. I mean, it's not just the novel coronavirus. It's also Ebola and Zika and HIV in the 1980s and West Nile virus and new kinds of Lyme disease, tick-borne disease. You know, we have a whole sort of host of these pathogens that are coming out of animal populations into humans because we are destroying wildlife habitat at such a huge rate. You know, we're losing 150 species every day. So this biodiversity crisis is the fundamental driver. So we need to, I think, look at that more deeply and consider human health to be connected to the health of our livestock, our wildlife, and our ecosystems more generally.
We're speaking with Sonia Shah. She's a science writer and the author of several books, including Pandemic, published in 2016. Her latest book is The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. One of the things you deal with in the book is the long-held idea that people on the move are aberrant, they're deviants, that it's kind of a threat. And it's interesting because you were born in the United States, but both your parents emigrated from India. And I'm interested in what your own experience was being in a country in the United States while you still had a lot of cultural ties and extended family in India. What it meant for your own sense of yourself and identity?
I mean, I think I adopted the sense I got from everyone around us that I was somehow out of place, that it's somehow, strange and anomalous for this body that traces its ancestry to the South Asian subcontinent to be present in North America. Like I would tell people where I'm from. I'm from New York City. That's where I was born. And they say, no, where are you really from? And that's a very common experience of many people of color in the United States that we're not believed. And we say, no, we're American. We were born here. Really, most of us are not more than one or two generations distant from an active long distance migration. And so, and all of us are migrants on some time scale or another, except for maybe a very few people in parts of Africa. And so really if anyone's anomalous, it's not me, it's the people who stayed still.
Right. You write that for centuries, leading intellectuals regarded migrating people and migrating animals even as aberrant, like kind of out of the natural order of things. That particular people, races, ethnic groups, and animal species had a natural homeland or habitat. That's where they belonged. Who propagated these ideas and how did they connect to the power structures of those of the time?
Well, I traced most of these ideas back to Linnaeus, Carl Linnaeus, who is considered the father of modern taxonomy. And he's this 18th century Swedish naturalist, and he kind of decided for all of us, well, where does everything belong? He named everything. And he came from a very Christian household, and like most naturalists of the time, he was very religious, and he thought of nature as an expression of God's perfection. So everything was in its rightful place for him, so wherever he found things, that's where they, quote unquote, belonged. And that extended to his human taxonomy. So he decided that, the people in Africa belong in Africa, the people in America, they belong in America, etc., to such an extent that he decided that all of these different peoples on different continents were not, didn't have a shared ancestry, a shared migration history, but were actually separate subspecies of humans. And in fact, he called Africans even less than human, that they were sort of a hybrid between real humans and this other archaic mythical human that he called troglodytes. But those ideas were incredibly influential because we see them today in our ideas about race and about where people belong and where wild species belong. When a wild creature crosses from a different place into a new territory, we think of it as an invasive. We call it an alien. And, we see hints of all of that in the way we make policy around immigration and newcomers in places around the world.
It's interesting that in the early 20th century, there were a lot of racist theories which held that immigration was a terrible thing, that it would dilute the purity of Americans. And along with this came the idea that animals, too, didn't migrate, right? I mean, animals had a place that they belonged. And, I guess the status of scientific and natural research wasn't yet in a position to really test that. You write that over the subsequent decades, we've come to understand just how much mass migration there is. You want to give us some examples of the distances that animals traverse routinely in migration?
Well, I think this is just starting to get mapped right now because we've had this absolute revolution in our ability to track the way animals move. I mean, in the past, we only could see animal movement sort of episodically in glimpses, you know. We didn't have batteries that lasted long enough to follow them around. And, you know, even if you were able to follow an animal around, you wouldn't have funding for it because animal movement was considered sort of instinctual and robotic. And, you know, there wasn't a lot of scientific interest in it. But what scientists are discovering now is that, you know, we're able to use new technology to study the way animals move. And so with solar technology and GPS, we can track animals 24/7 over the course of their lifetime, sort of continuously. So you can see the full picture of the way they move. And what they're finding is that these creatures are moving farther and faster and in more complex and responsive ways, dynamic ways than anyone ever thought before. And, you know, what's funny is like we've created all these parks and reservations to kind of protect animals. And when we've actually now studied, well, where do they actually go? It turns out, well, the giraffes, you know, they're supposed to stay in the park in Ethiopia that we set aside for them. In fact, they're crossing borders and going, you know, much farther than that. The turtles are swimming well beyond the boundaries of the marine protected zones we've made up for them. And we see animals are moving sort of en masse now because of the climate crisis, you know, the climate change, that tens of thousands of species are moving towards the poles and up into the heights, including, you know, creatures that we don't think of as mobile. You know, we think of coral reefs, for example, as very still, as stone walls, essentially, and coral reefs are moving. Coral polyps around Japan, for example, have moved about 14 kilometers every year since the 1930s. Forests are moving up the Himalayan mountains, climbing uphill 19 meters a decade. And, you know, there's some animals that have moved even farther, like Atlantic cod, which have shifted more than 200 kilometers every decade. So there's just this sense that we're just being revealed to us of a planet that's on the move in a very dynamic, responsive way.
Right. And then you have plenty of animals that have long, regular migration routes. I mean, these little tiny monarch butterflies, you know, go from New England to Mexico thousands of miles. Eels cross the Atlantic. And I'm wondering what your sense, what's the lesson for us about this constant motion among animal species? What's the lesson for our understanding of human migration?
I think what we can see in animals is that their mobility allows them to adapt to environmental change. So we see in bird species, for example, if they rely on seasonally available fruits, they migrate more often than bird species that, say, feed on insects that are available year-round. Bats that live in trees, they migrate more than bat species that live in caves. Arthropods that live in seasonal ponds migrate more than those who live inside forests. So the more exposed you are to environmental change and variation, the more likely you are to migrate. And whole ecosystems depend on animals on the move. You know, we see that, and this is something that's a complete reversal to how scientists used to think of wild migrants as sort of parasites, you know, as disruptors and parasites. What we now understand is that, you know, over 90% of the trees in rainforests, for example, rely on the movement of birds and other animals to disperse their seeds. So wild migrants and wild movements really build the scaffolding for a lot of our ecosystems. So we can see that in the natural world. So what does that mean about the way we move? Well, we know that our bodies are not attuned and specifically adapted to specific niches. You know, the way that Linnaeus and the race scientists of the early 20th century thought of the human body as very specifically adapted to a certain place. So the African body was adapted to African environments, the European body to temperate European climates, etc. And that's not what we now know about the human body. I mean, our genes are not, you know, they don't robotically dictate how our bodies function and our how our bodies develop. And we're very fungible. Our genes are very responsive to environmental signals around the genes themselves, from the diets of our mothers, from the climates we're exposed to. And that kind of fluidity and responsiveness, it's what allows our bodies to thrive in such widely variable places, from the Tibetan plateau to the middle of rainforests. And it's not the kind of thing that doesn't evolve in species that are staying in one place and that are highly adapted to one specific location. Our bodies are just the opposite. We're very fungible. And so our bodies really are built to migrate. So you have to think about like the whole picture of why did we evolve this way, and how did migration come to be such a prominent part of our history? It's because its benefits outweighed its risks over the long term. So this whole idea of migration as a crisis is what I'm trying to kind of interrogate. And it seems to me that it could be just the opposite, that migration isn't the crisis. Migration is the solution.
You write in the book that the next great migration is upon us. Is this the migration driven by climate change?
Yeah, that's what's happening with wild species. Up to 80% of wild species that have been tracked are moving towards the poles and up into altitude. And we see also migration patterns in humans are also changing. And so, you know, given what we understand, that migration is a response to environmental change and a way to adapt to environmental change, we can predict that as the climate changes, that we're going to continue to see, you know, a new kind of migration happening.
Well, Sonia Shah, thank you so much for speaking with us again.
Thank you.
Sonia Shah spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies. Her new book is called The Next Great Migration, The Beauty and Terror of Life on the Move. Her 2016 book is called Pandemic, Tracking Contagions from Cholera to Ebola and Beyond.